How does radioactivity impact on the body and the cell, and how does a low-level radioactivity impact and a high-dose impact? What is the difference?
Well, it's interesting that you should ask, because this is really a key concept, a key and very crucial idea. A high short dose is 100 to 1,000 times less harmful because the DNA can repair itself. A low dose, which is chronic due to stuff that we inhaled or ingested and that sits in our bone like strontium 90 for 20, 30, 50 years, that's much more deadly, because at the very low, gentle rates of radiation, it does its damage by producing so-called free radicals, which are unstable forms of molecules that normally don't exist in the body, like ordinary oxygen that we have, that we need to breathe. That gets converted into a toxic form, sort of like ozone. And it's also short-lived, like ozone, and it attacks cell membranes. And it actually dissolves cell membranes over a period of 10 minutes, a half hour afterwards. And so an entire large cell can be destroyed by a single oxygen molecule. And that's why it is so effective. And this process is much more efficient at low doses than at high doses. At high doses, so many of these oxygen reactive free radicals are formed, they bump into each other. And they deactivate each other. And as a result, they don't have as great an effect as when they're at low concentration. So we have the ironic situation that a little bit of radiation, millirad for millirad, is 1,000 times worse than a high dose from a bomb flash at Hiroshima. And so the data in Hiroshima, which we've all heard about, has recently been revised, is just the tip of the iceberg. It was not the most serious effect. The most serious effect is the fallout from the bombs, not the direct flash. The stuff that scatters around the globe, that gets into our food, that gets into the vegetable, the grain, and into the soil, into our apple juice and orange juice and milk and beef and chicken, and everything is polluted.
Okay, now I'd like to mention two articles which actually I think occurred during the same week in the New York Times. One was June 23, 1990, that was entitled, Panel Proposes Cut and Radiation Limit. And I'll quote from there that it says, damage estimated tripled since the 1977 recommendations were drafted. Scientists have tripled their estimate of the damage inflicted by a given dose of radiation. And it says that we have run a higher level of risk than we had expected. And at the same time, I have a press release here dated June 20th, 1990 from the Nuclear Information and Resource Service in Washington, D.C. that talks about the NRC planning to deregulate the amount of radioactivity which is permissible and considered safe to be released into the environment by the nuclear industry. These seem to be a direct contradiction here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is a great tragedy that we have in our nation, that because we have been so committed to nuclear weapons, and because our government felt that its security depended on building and testing all these weapons, we could not face the newly developing scientific evidence that radiation, even at Hiroshima, was much more serious in its cancer-producing effect than we had thought. But it's worse than that, because the Chernobyl effect, which involves radioactive substances, not the direct flash from the bomb, that gets into the diet, like the strontium 90, the iodine 131, is 1,000 times more serious, not just 3 times more serious than was believed before. And yet, these people, because they are determined to go ahead with the production of nuclear weapons and the continued generation of electricity by this very dirty method of generating it, you know, producing this waste that nobody knows what to do with for tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, poisoning the earth, these people are determined to go ahead, and they want to do this before the public has a chance to be fully educated on the whole new discoveries around Chernobyl and what's happened since then.
I see. Do you recall more information about that particular article in terms of how they were describing and deciding they were going to use wastes from the nuclear industry?
Yes, and it's very disturbing. They were going to allow it. About 30% of all the nuclear waste, they say, is so low that it will give less than 10 millirads, and that's only 10% of the natural radiation, and therefore it can be added to ordinary landfills, it could be made into consumer products, even toys in theory and things like that, household utensils, metal, scrap metal that's radioactive can be made into radioactive forks and things like that. I mean, this is the madness of the nuclear industry that does not want and cannot admit that we made a gigantic mistake in underestimating the seriousness of low-level radiation. I think we have an enormous, important role to play now to protect our children by requiring our states to not to permit the distribution of radioactive waste in our normal landfills, and that we should oppose and write to our congressmen and senators and not allow this new method of spreading low-level radioactivity, especially since Dr. Alice Stewart's study, just done in England a few years ago, shows that every millirem, one millirem in the environment, roughly increases the leukemia rate among children 1%. Now, that is an enormous burden for a society to pay, and any saving that the nuclear industry is trying to achieve is completely countered by the total social impact of increasing our childhood leukemia and low birth weight rate in our society.
Are you familiar with what occurred with fluoride in terms of aluminum processing years ago, and how fluoride ended up being added to our water, and even eventually we were led to believe that this was healthful and even a requirement for the health of our teeth and bones? Is what is occurring now with the deregulation of nuclear waste and radioactive contamination not similar to what occurred then with the waste byproducts of the aluminum industry?
It is somewhat analogous, but it's much more serious.
And the reason that I brought that up was to say that this process that we are in the midst of now has happened before, only now it's much more dangerous, of course, because the materials that we're working with...
And the mistakes have been made because an industry was trying to get rid of waste products and byproducts. The same thing is true, by the way, for food irradiation.
Right.
The reason that food irradiation is being pushed by the government is to get rid or find a use for all the nuclear waste. The cesium-137 is supposed to go to food irradiators, and there would, you know, irradiate our strawberries and our oranges and our all the food to be eaten in the supermarket. In the process, millions and tens of millions of curies, which are trillions of times of what we worry about in our milk, are supposedly planted all over the nation in food irradiators, which contain many, much more toxic substances than any other source other than a nuclear reactor. So just in order to help one industry and poison the nation is not a very intelligent thing.
Okay. Since you mentioned it, I would like to add, just for clarification purposes, that food irradiation is not the irradiating of food from fallout. It is the intentional exposing of foods to highly radioactive materials as a means of, in quotes, I say this, extending shelf life.
Right. And killing bacteria
and
allowing it to be stored without refrigeration.
Right. And this is being promoted by the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy as a means of subsidizing the reprocessing of waste from the nuclear industry.
That's exactly right. And that has been the main reason all along, because there is no real rational justification for this kind of procedure because of its enormous danger in terms of both the effect on the food, which is still not fully understood, and in some studies has shown genetic, you know, congenital defect in children who've been fed this kind of food, animals and so on in India and other places. But the really terrible thing is that these enormous quantities of cesium-137, which is just like the stuff that came out of Chernobyl, would be placed in food irradiators all over where it already has leaked, in the case of New Jersey, not far from New York, into the underground water system and is poisoning the water supplies of people. So we must end the production of fission products. we have the evidence, if we want to face it, that we can have a future that is healthy. We can have a future free from this huge rise in cancer. We can probably cut cancer by 50 to 80% if we are willing to enforce our own findings and say no more releases of radiation into the environment. And as a result, there is much hope for the future, but we have to be willing to do without nuclear weapons and without the mistake of putting our nuclear reactors into our most richest dairy countries.
I'd like to ask you what the half-lives are of these elements which are used in the nuclear industry, what exactly half-life means, and whether or not they can be safely stored, because it's my impression that the life of the elements which these radioactive chemicals are stored in is not as long as the active period of the chemicals themselves.
Well, that's absolutely right. There are some that have half-lives of 16 million years. Iodine-129 has a half-life of 16 million years, and nobody knows how to store it safely because it moves along cracks and rocks so easily. There's plutonium that has a half-life of 24,000 years. There's strontium-90 that has a half-life of 30 years, which will be too serious for thousands of years, hundreds to thousands of years, and cesium-137 and cobalt and many, many other substances of long half-lives.
So what exactly, then, is a half-life for people who don't know what that means?
Well, a half-life is simply the time in which the radioactivity dies down by one half. Like if I have a certain number of disintegrations per second, an amount of iodine here, in 1 week it will have gone down to about one half the count rate, the number of clicks per second. And another week it will be one half of that, down to a quarter. And another week later, it'll be one half of that, down to one eighth. But it never goes away completely.
I've heard talk that perhaps even this government, if not in Europe, there are plans to introduce what is being called a new safe nuclear reactor that no longer poses any threat.
Well,
is this actually possible?
No. In fact, there have been recent articles in Scientific American and in Science that point out that there is no such thing as an absolutely safe reactor. These new reactors are supposed to be less dependent on human operators and less dependent on certain coolant pumps working, but nothing is safe from human errors or mechanical design. And as long as you have these millions upon millions of curies, I mean, people don't realize that in a single nuclear reactor, we are storing at any one moment the equivalent of 1,000 Hiroshima bombs worth of radioactivity. I mean, Chernobyl showed that Europe was devastated by radioactive fallout that was greater in Europe than that from all the bombs previously detonated. And there were 40,000 nuclear bombs detonated since the time of the first one. The equivalent of 40,000 Hiroshima bombs. So we are dealing with the most deadly possible way of generating electricity. It's mad. It's simply done because we wanted to build bombs, and that's how originally our government promoted nuclear energy as a way of making people believe that bomb fallout from the testing they were doing in Nevada was not going to hurt anybody. Well, I did meet Albert Einstein as a very young man. In fact, I was just a graduate student at George Washington University, and I was working on the theory of electron emission from solids, and I also had a great interest in some of the questions of basic quantum theory that quarreled between him and Niels Bohr, another great scientist, and so I wrote him a letter and said, could I come and see you and talk to you about these things? And lo and behold, 3 days later, I had an invitation to come to see him. And it was, you know, I was shaking in my boots walking down the street in Princeton, approaching this little white clapboard house in Princeton. And it was a wonderful day in the spring of 1947. That was a very long time ago. And you know, there, you know, I was ushered into the house and waited in the dining room, and then came down the shuffling walk of this man, and there he was in his white hair, standing up and
in his exercise suit, you know, one of these gray gym suits, baggy pants and all. And he said, well, he said, young man, shall we sit on the back porch? It's really funny. It was a beautiful day. The roses were in bloom. And we sat there and he said, well, tell me about things. And so we got started talking about my technical scientific work. But the interesting thing was, he said, well, now let's talk about the important things, you know. And then he started talking about the big problems of the philosophy of quantum theory against his own belief that there was, that God did not play dice with the world, that there really was meaning and hopefully a way of understanding things in detail, you know. And then we had, you know, then somebody came and said, well, somebody else is waiting for you, Dr. Einstein. And he said, oh, he says, be quiet. He says, just sit here. I'll be right back. And then he came back and we went on. And he apparently enjoyed talking with me. And then we got talking about lots of other things, politics. And of course, it was 1947, was only 2 years after the bomb. So I know what was so much of concern in his mind when he kept saying, well, you know, I made so many mistakes in my life. And then he started telling me what not to do. He said, don't go back to graduate school. They'll crush every bit of originality out of you. He said, be careful. You can't be a genius every day. Have a shoemaker's job. Be sure not to put all your eggs in one basket. And don't try to solve all the grandest problems of the world, you know, trying to unify all the theories of physics that he was trying to do. And as a matter of fact, a few hours later, and I was there for 5 hours, I couldn't believe it, one visitor after another, he said, just wait a minute, I'll get rid of him. So it was 6 o'clock by the time I came at one and I left at six. And, you know, it was a shattering. It was a wonderful experience, but what was so shattering was that he was such a depressed person, that he was so unhappy and so guilty, felt so awful about what he knew was going to be a fantastic, dangerous period for the human race. The development of the atomic bomb, which he recommended to Roosevelt, you know, was on his mind. And in 1947, they had just done the first bomb test series in the Pacific, and he knew a terrible arms race was going on. And he felt so, you know, enormously guilty about having participated in getting it going and not knowing how to stop it now. And then he was very much concerned about making certain that I would not make the kinds of mistakes he made. He says, never allow yourself to be crushed by people of authority, you know, and maintain your ideas, fight for them, don't give up early in life. They'll crush it every time you raise a new idea. And that has helped me enormously in all these years to withstand the criticism and the attacks and the vicious things that were said about me for decades and decades. It was because he sort of immunized me against all this. He said, they'll try to crush every bit of independent thought and originality out of you. And sure enough, when I went back to Cornell and a few years later, 2 years later, and I tried to get one of the professors, whose name I will not mention, to accept the work that Einstein thought was rather good for my thesis, this professor turned me down, you know, on what basis? He said, I tried it. It can't be done. And I said, thank you, Professor such and such. And I walked out and I found somebody else who did supervise my thesis, and I got it published. And later on, I sent a copy of the abstract of that paper to Einstein, and just at the time of his 75th birthday, and it was a wonderful thing, because a little later, he wrote me a note with a thank you card that he sent to everybody who, you know, congratulated him on his 75th birthday. And across the back, he scrawled, be stubborn, be persistent. That's really the key to what you have to do. When you're in a battle of this kind, or any new idea, as he was, you know, unifying all the theories of nature, all the theories of physics at the time, and he couldn't do it at the time. He failed. He took me upstairs to the study around 5 o'clock, and he said, you see all these papers here spread on this table? He said, I will never know whether they have any meaning whatsoever. And he was really, you know, very depressed because his whole life he had hoped to find the unified theory of everything. And he couldn't do it. And he said, and don't try to put all your effort into just doing one thing. And it turned out that in these years, I have, in fact, been pursuing a theory of elementary particles and the origin of the universe, which I've just begun to publish a few years ago, over the last 10 or 15 years. And the pieces have come in very slowly, piece by piece. But it looks as if he was right. And now everyone believes that sooner or later we will all find a single theory that will combine gravity and electromagnetism and all the different forces of nature into a single kind of force. And nobody wanted to believe him. In the early 40s and 50s, he was isolated. People at Princeton University referred to him as a person who he said, oh, he is a has-been. Can you believe this? They said about Einstein that he is a has-been, because he was pursuing his deep conviction that all nature must be unified and beautiful and simple. And I think the majority of young theoretical physicists today believe he was right. And sooner or later, we are going to find this unified theory. But I think what it has done over the years for me, this enormously moving interview with a man who, you know, to me, he was such a godlike figure, that a godlike figure like that should constantly bemoan the mistakes he made, it allowed me to say, well, if Einstein can mistakes, so can many other scientists who say that radiation is safe or that you can't unify the theories of nature. And it gave me the ability to resist and fight all these years and to ignore the attempts to keep me quiet and to keep at it for all the years that it took to persuade people that we have made a terrible mistake. And that is now fortunately beginning to become true, that the whole world now recognizes that the reliance on nuclear power, as Chernobyl has now shown, is a terrible disaster potentially for any nation, and that we must find less serious ways of generating energy, less damaging ways.
Dr. Sternglass, you've been doing this work for so many years now, since the late 50s. You've been around the world, you've recently come back from the Soviet Union, you've seen a lot of what you've predicted become fact. For instance, in the last 2 years, the New York Times has been full of criticism, trenchant criticism of the Department of Energy. It seems that 10 years ago, of course, people like you, and well before that, were giving the same kind of criticism and nothing happened. Years later, the Department of Energy admits through the General Accounting Office studies, one thing and another, that there's tremendous problems in those areas without even getting into the disposal of nuclear wastes. How does it make you feel when you see the mainstream establishment media and figures finally come to recognize that people like you were very right in your predictions? Do they ever acknowledge you? Is there any?
Well, they have recently acknowledged Dr. Alice Stewart. There was a big article by Schneider in the New York Times about the enormously important work of Dr. Alice Stewart, who was the first one to point out the danger of low-level radiation, especially for the newborn, and who essentially was a person who inspired me. So that process has begun. And I think a few of us are not going to be welcome, because we have been more vocal in our criticism of the establishment and more effective in this country against the nuclear industry. And so I don't expect, even in my lifetime, to be acknowledged for what I've tried to do. But I feel wonderful because I've just had a grandchild that I hopefully think is going to be well, a newborn baby that hopefully will come into a new world. And that's my satisfaction, my reward.
We'd like to thank Sheldon Walden for engineering for us, Matt Schottenfeld for composing the theme music for this program, and Enya Singakan and Kim Robertson for the concluding music. If you'd like to receive a list of printed scientific studies conducted by Dr. Sternglass concerning the information you have just heard, or studies on the scientifically documented correlation between nuclear weapon testing and earthquakes, or a copy of the United States Constitution or the Virginia Bill of Rights, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to Golden, Box 7, 228 East 10th Street, New York, New York, 10003, or call 212-459-4867. We also ask that you make copies of this tape and share them with your friends and family members. Our future is in our own hands, and knowledge of the facts is imperative to our handling it responsibly. Our nuclear industry is a symptom of a sociological illness. We can heal it if we so desire. In closing, I would like to share some insights on this topic of Dr. Edward Bach, an English physician who discovered the Bach flower remedies approximately 100 years ago. The main reason for the failure of modern medical science is that it is dealing with results and not causes. For many centuries, the real nature of disease has been masked by materialism, and thus disease itself has been given every opportunity of extending its ravages since it has not been attacked at its origin. The real primary diseases of man are such defects as pride, cruelty, hate, narcissism, ignorance, instability, and greed. And each of these, if considered, will be found to be adverse to unity. Such defects as these are the real diseases, and it is a continuation and persistence in such defects after we have reached the stage of the development when we know them to be wrong, which precipitates in the body the injurious results which we know as illness. Resist not evil. Sickness and wrong are to be conquered by direct fighting, not, but by replacing them by good. Darkness is removed by light, not by greater darkness. Hate by love, cruelty by sympathy and pity, and disease by health. Our whole objective is to realize our faults and endeavor so to develop the opposing virtue that the fault will disappear from us like snow melts in the sunshine. Don't fight your worries. Don't struggle with your disease. Don't grapple with your infirmities. Rather, forget them in concentrating on the development of the virtue you require. Thank you.
Yeah.